This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're revisiting the theme of anxiety, one of our most common themes, with it being one of the most common areas of mental health. And to start off, I've got a definition from the Mental Health Foundation. Anxiety is a feeling of unease, worry, or fear, which, when persistent and impacting on daily life, may be a sign of an anxiety disorder. And I really like that definition because it highlights there the difference between anxiety, the feeling, and anxiety as a group of conditions within the mental health world.
Yeah, I thought that when I read it, actually. I really liked it, which is why it's in there, because, yeah, just as what you said, repeating really, Bob, but yeah, the difference is that we all can feel levels of anxiety at times, you know, and it's mixed with adrenaline and all those different feelings that we get anyway, and an increased heart rate. And I was once doing, in fact, I think you were with me.
Oh.
No, you weren't. I was once session, we got everybody to stand up just to kind of really just to give a glimpse to people of what we're talking about, and just ask people in a room to like go to one end of a room or the other end of a room, depending on like zero anxiety or any kind of feelings of nervousness at one end, just to show the real difference in how people feel in different events. And just things like, you know, going to a job interview and got everybody to shuffle around in the room, or, you know, going on a first date or walking to a restaurant on your own, or, you know, just real simple kind of things, but just to show, you know, it really demonstrated it to the group that we were working with. But, you know, we really are all different. It's really important to recognize that. And as you said, when it becomes consistent, then it might lead into actually being diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. And that's when obviously we need to look at that and get some help.
Right, for sure. And I love that particular task they get people to do really highlights the weirdos like me that don't get nervous for job interviews. I just enjoy them. I find them quite exciting. But I think that distinction is also really important, not just for understanding the difference, you know, what is and isn't a symptom of mental ill health, but also I think it can be quite empowering to understand that difference. You know, on one hand, we've got to look at some anxiety is situational and very understandable and not a symptom of something bigger, but equally, there is anxiety that is something bigger and that needs addressing. You know, one of the things I read in the research that's particularly heartbreaking is that oftentimes people at the point of diagnosis for anxiety can't remember when they last didn't feel anxious. And I think that's something that many people relate to and many people won't, and that's the difference. But one thing is, a lot more people are relating to that at the moment than usual. So we've got some stats here looking at the pandemic and how, in particular, the first lockdown affected rates of anxiety. So the Office of National Statistics have recently published their figures from that time and found a marked increase in anxiety at the beginning of the original lockdown, with almost half, so 49.6% of people reporting high anxiety. And that's in comparison to 21% at the same time in 2019.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a huge difference, but it seems understandable, right? Because at the beginning, there was so much uncertainty. And then we kind of maybe started to understand what might be going on and adjust to our new environment. So there still were increased levels of anxiety throughout the year, and there still are now. But interesting that right at the beginning, it was at the highest, when we don't know. And a bit like that example I gave before, you know, when we don't know what's coming up, we're unsure about what environment we're going to enter. We don't know what it's going to be like, the interview. The unknowing like builds up these feelings of anxiousness in us.
Right. Well, it's difficult, more difficult than normal then to, I think, take that anxiety level down when the whole world's genuinely anxiety inducing. The element of being able to somewhat rationalize yourself out of it isn't accessible. And so reading a stat like that, I actually find very validating and empowering to think, we knew we could feel it amongst the people that we know that the anxiety was that high at that point. So in a way, it's quite nice to look at the stat now and be like, okay, that was real. This is measurable, recordable. You know, it wasn't that we were doing badly because at times anxiety can make you feel like that. It was that this is very common and an understandable reaction to a horrible situation. And so it's, you know, even though there's been a delay, as there often is with statistics being reported, it's nice to then look at that and be able to apply that to the lockdown now. And if we're feeling anxious at this point, again, it's relatively understandable. But equally, there is support out there. And the other thing I found interesting was how it flipped so many things on its head in terms of normal stats around anxiety. So the ONS also reported that during that period, those in marriages or civil partnerships were among the highest rates of anxiety, whereas normally they are right at the bottom of the list. And equally, people over the age of 75 were almost twice as likely to be experience anxiety as those 16 to 24 during lockdown. And that's interesting because I didn't feel it. You know, at the time, you don't really feel like one group is more anxious than another, but maybe that's part of the effect of the older age groups having a fear proportionate to the threat of the virus for them.
Absolutely. And you heard me laugh then, and it was a bit of a, I guess it felt like an insecure, I can believe the statistic around people who are married or in partnerships, because, but again, how interesting that we all view things so differently and our experience of the world is so different. So you've got people who would say to me who are single with their children, oh, you're so lucky that you've got somebody else in the house. Whereas then myself and friends who are also in relationship are like, oh, it's the dream to be single right now, even with your kids. You make your own decisions, you make your own choices, the kids doing what you're telling them, not somebody else giving them, you know, a chocolate bar when you know you've already given them one after lunch and now somebody else is coming 10 minutes later and giving them a treat and you're like, they've just had chocolate, they don't need any more, or, you know, whatever it might be, small example, but it's really, whatever your own situation is so relative to you. Yeah, it just made me smile then reading that statistic about married couples. I feel like I want to like shout at the rooftops to my single friends who are like, oh, you're so lucky, there's two pairs of hands in the house. Like, no, it's the opposite. But yeah, it's relative. And then of course, you know, the older generation and those over 75.
Right, because it confirms what we knew. And so even though it's not confirming good stuff, it is kind of reassuring to be like, okay, so there was really something there. You know, I wasn't projecting anxiety onto people. People were, as a nation, feeling pretty anxious. And if you ever wanted an example of a very clear link between physical health and mental health, there it is. You know, those that were more at risk of developing more severe reaction to the virus were the ones that were generally more anxious when we look at age. And then you had one stat in terms of self-harm, which we don't often see stats on. So that's interesting.
Yeah, it was in relation to ethnic minority groups. And it really interests me, and it's made me want to look further into this. Fewer than 5% of people have reported self-harming during lockdown. The reports have been around 70% higher amongst that group. And it really interests me because culturally, as a Black woman, and from my community, self-harm isn't something that we really talk about or see very often within our groups. But 70% increase is huge. It really got me thinking.
It's massive, and it's one of many things we just don't associate. And then you wonder, is it that that's more hidden as opposed to being less common?
Well, absolutely. There are cultural barriers to talking about mental health in the first place. But if you think about the last year and images that we've seen online and on the TV and through media of complete brutality and racism towards Black people and the marches and the campaigns and everything that's gone on, it's not surprising, you know. And within racism, there's an element called internalized racism, which really is all about negative stereotyping of people from your own race and everything that Black people have gone through and all the racism that's completely systemic and still out there now, internalized racism has become even more apparent. And I guess if somebody's experiencing this, maybe you could see a link to self-harm. actually.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's something that certainly I know there's been a lot of studies correlating self-worth and self-harm. So those with lower self-worth are more likely to self-harm. It's not cause and effect, but there is that potential link. And so for a group experiencing issues around self-worth in that specific way, it would make sense that self-harm follows that. So really interesting. And so they're the stats we have on anxiety. And we've also come along with a really brilliant guest who we've wanted to interview for some time. And it's really been, for me, one of the best interviews we've ever had. And so that's with our guest, Felicity Ward, who's an incredible comedian, one of the UK's best. So she shares a lot about anxiety, which was the original theme for the episode. We also get into depression, postnatal depression as well, specifically, and IBS. So I may reflect that in the episode title in some way as well. So wonderful comic. You will have seen a lot of her on your screens, including recently, as of Sunday, my mum sent me a photo of her TV to say, isn't this the one you said you interviewed? Because she was on the 10 o'clock news talking about comedy in lockdown.
Yay! Brilliant. I'm so excited for the interview to come out and to hear the feedback from it, because I know that it was amazing and you've been really looking forward to interviewing her.
Yeah, it's a real good one. And by all means, listeners, anytime you want to give us feedback, we're also very open to hearing guests that you want to come back on, particular themes you'd like us to cover. You can contact us with our Instagram DMs or via our website. Also, if you enjoy listening to me interview this comedian, you can hear me interview many, many more over on our other podcast, Dating Games, the Modern Relationships podcast, which launched back in October. And yeah, we really hope more of you can go over and give that a try. I know it's a strange time for a dating podcast, but for me personally, in this time when I'm not able to date, I'm actually really enjoying reading books about it, speaking to wonderful guests about it, and sort of feeling like I'm brushing up on my skills, because otherwise I'll get back to post-lockdown life and I will struggle to know how to talk to anybody, let alone anyone I might fancy. So yeah, definitely check that out. The link is in the episode description every week for that one as well. So with all that said, please enjoy this interview with the incredible Felicity Ward. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Felicity Ward and I'm an Australian comedian who lives in London. We didn't talk about mental illness at all when I was younger because I was born in the Jurassic period. And the earliest memory that feels like it was definitely connected, because I also have irritable bowel syndrome, it's quite a funny story in that I was part of a Friday night church group, a youth group, as they called it, and they would go on little excursions and stuff like that. And we went to the movies and we all caught the minibus and we went and saw a film. On the way home, I had an IBS attack while I was in the bus, and the panic of figuring out how this was all going to play out and whether I was going to go back to the church and see if I would make it there, or do I just get off early and say, I'll just walk down the hill to my house. Can we swear on this podcast?
Yeah.
The long and short of it is I sat behind a bus stop, 10:30 at night, and I'm in a very small town, so no one saw me, I think. But it's on like the main road of the small town, but a main road is not, there's no shops on that road. It's just residential. But yeah, that's like IBS is the earliest recognizable incidences I had with anxiety, because they're almost inextricably linked. And you might know this already, but after your brain, the most amount of nerves in your whole body are in your bowels and your intestines. So hypersensitive. And then that was an ongoing thing and has been an ongoing thing for most of my life. And I used to catch a bus to school that would take nearly an hour. And there was a long stretch where there were no shops or petrol stations or libraries or anywhere. So there was like 20 minutes of the bus ride that I would be in a sweat every day, wondering if I would have an attack. And sort of, yeah, just living that very quiet nightmare twice a day for 4 years.
Which no doubt didn't help the situation.
No, no. If you just worry about the thing that you're worried about, it very rarely solves the anxiety, although we keep trying it. If I think about it a lot, maybe it will go away.
Yeah, that's very true. That's a fun way of looking at it. And yeah. I'm interested to know with what you mentioned about trying to distinguish the two, anxiety and IBS, because I think there's a lot of these situations with mental health where you're like, at what point is it a symptom versus its own condition? So how do you tend to draw those lines?
I find that for me, they're almost inextricably linked. So I probably had anxiety before that, but I also remember having IBS attacks before that. Actually, I just remembered, you know, like I do have symptoms that if I eat too much, I will often have an IBS attack if there's certain foods, but it can also really change for me. And I'm also too lazy to do anything about that. So like,
what, in terms of your diet?
Yeah, there's sometimes I'm at home, I'm like, no, I feel like ice cream and I'm just going to deal with it. I'm at home, it's fine. So I have less of an attachment of fear to having an IBS attack now than I used to. And that's been a process as well. But when I was younger and I didn't know the phrase irritable bowel syndrome till I was like 23 and I went to a doctor, 24. I was also hitting the booze very hard at the time. And surprise, surprise, when you take alcohol out of your system, it really does improve your IBS.
Yeah, you're not drinking diluted poison, because that's what I have to remind myself. As much as it's a normalised part of society, it is diluted poison.
Yeah. When have you ever had a hangover and woken up and gone, oh, I just feel really centred and like I've meditated? No, you wake up and you're like a bit shaky and everything's a bit louder and like it just attacks your nervous system in a hangover. So if you have a problem with your nervous system with anxiety, that's a terrible combination. I stopped drinking a long time ago. I'm not suggesting that everyone needs to do that, but I am suggesting that if you drink and you have anxiety, it's probably having a negative effect on that as well.
Right. And I think both that and IBS, you have part of the complication is the time delay.
Yeah.
I wonder if you were feeling the symptoms as soon as you had your first spoon of ice cream, would that put you off?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I can smell things that will give me an IBS attack often. Like,
wow.
If I smell like a chicken mushroom creamy pasta, I'll smell it and go, oh no, I can't eat that. I know that I can't eat that because my stomach's like, blah, 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 blah. It's not all the time, but sometimes that's my superpower. I can smell what's going to make me shit myself.
I mean, that's useful. I think my superpower is a lot less useful. I'm really good at telling when people are going to let me down, but it's always too late. I've never been in a situation where that knowledge has helped me change it. So we do get it, including with podcasting. I will be able to, on a morning, say to my team, they're going to cancel last minute. And I'm right. And there's nothing I can do with that information. It's the most useless thing. So I've just had to try and make my peace with it. But it sounds like yours, you can actually change your behaviour.
Yeah, it's good. The things that give me IBS, I don't usually crave because they smell like they're going to make me sick. I don't naturally have a craving. So that's worked out quite well. But often IBS will just be because I'm so stressed. It's very linked to my stress levels. So if I've got a lot on and I eat a big meal, my body will go, all right, we're shutting down here. Or rather, it's an evacuation.
Oh, God. And so you've got this period when you're younger, you're hiding the anxiety and the IBS symptoms from people at school. Mm. Was that also something you were hiding at home?
Yeah, I didn't recognise it as a problem at home because, I mean, when I was younger, I assumed everyone was like me. You know, I assumed home life, the way it was for me, is how it was for everyone. I assumed that people thought like me. I was a really energetic kid, but I also had this real lovely faith in myself. Like when people didn't want to be friends with me, I was like, why wouldn't you want to be friends with me? I'm fun. Doesn't everyone want to be friends with me? I learned later on that not everyone wanted to be friends with me. So when I would have IBS attacks, when I was on the bus, I thought this is abnormal. Like everyone knows you don't want to shoot yourself when you're a kid. But I didn't know that that could be linked to anything more than being near a toilet is being safe for me. And so there was no one that I talked to about it. It's funny because I didn't get diagnosed with depression till I was 30 or anxiety. And then I was 23 when a doctor suggested I read these books on irritable bowel syndrome. So none of this language was around. So I wasn't really even curious about my experience. I just thought I was me. And it's funny, I've genuinely never thought about it until now. And I've talked about mental health for a decade. There was also like, there was some dysfunction at home that 100% contributed to my hyper state and my hyper alert state. You know, looking back at it, I'm like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But at the time, again, I thought that everyone's household was probably similar and I thought that everyone felt like me. So it wasn't like, oh, I feel so weird. Oh, why doesn't it? It was the opposite. I'm like, oh, surely everyone feels like they're living life on a knife edge. Who wouldn't want to get more excited if they're already excited? Who wouldn't want to like amplify their feelings? And I had really big feelings.
Right. And I often say that, that growing up is an experience in learning what's a you thing and what's an everyone thing.
Mm.
And that's the big things like that. But it's also the small things. Like it took into my adulthood to realise that always wearing shoes indoors is actually quite uncommon in this country.
Yeah, right.
Just little things. But that's your context. Like when you are really little, your whole world is kind of via the lens of your parents and their experiences. And so it's not a surprise when certain traumas, certain conditions are passed down. Do you mind sharing a bit of what that sort of turbulence you alluded to was like at home?
My dad was a drinker and that created a lot of uncertainty and unpredictability. Like I talk about anxiety as always being ready. You don't know what for, but you're always ready. And I suppose when you grow up with unpredictability, if that's a word, you don't know if there's going to be a party at your house that night or if your dad is going to turn up when he said he was going to turn up. And then he doesn't, it's fine. But then he doesn't and it's not fine. And so I think people that grow up with dysfunction in their house have, I think this is pretty common, that they have an innate ability to read the temperature of the room wherever they go. You know, like if dad wasn't in a good mood, we would all be walking on eggshells that night. Or we would all know to be quiet. But if dad was in a good mood, then we'd all be in a good mood, you know. So it was like, all right, what are we doing tonight? And I don't think I've ever talked about this. And it's like I'm really wary because I don't want to shame my dad because now being a parent, it's just, it's so hard. It's the best and I love it. But I can see how easily you can not be your best self as a parent, and that it's a constant daily reminder that you are shaping a brain and you are shaping a future and you are shaping a heart. And that has to be a really, for me, has to be a really conscious choice, because if I look after him way better than I look after myself, like I look after my son much better than I look after myself. And actually part of looking after him is looking after myself. And that's an example that I need to set as well. So yeah, it's I'm a like notoriously honest comedian, but I'm also very sensitive about talking about other people when they don't have control of the narrative thing. So I would like to remind people that this is my experience and my side of the story, and that's only one side of the story.
Right. And I think you've phrased it in such a compassionate way, because I think there's such truth to that with parenting, where it's actually terrifying to be a parent, but you're not really allowed to admit to that. So all these parents are going around worrying that at any moment they could really make some big mistakes. You know, the stuff that my parents have said in the heat of the moment that I've remembered and will possibly remember forever. Yeah. And in hindsight, as an adult now myself, I can see, okay, with context, they were mad. They didn't really mean it. But I'm sure I will carry that on if I ever have a kid of my own, and that same fear will live in me.
Yeah, and that thing of like, you can say something as a parent that seems completely innocuous, but because your child is a teenager, because they've already been called that at school maybe, or they're really sensitive about it, because these are the people that made you, you're like, surely you don't have any fault. You can't have faults because you're making me, you're growing me, you're teaching me. And if you're a sensitive person like me, things can hurt more than they usually would. And also when you hear, I don't know if you've had this experience, sometimes you hear other people talking about their parents and you go, you know what, that sounds like a mistake that anyone could make. It's so hard to be objective about your own personal experience with your parents. Like I can look at things that my parents have done and gone, I totally know why you did that, given what was passed on to you, given the generation that you came from, given the environment, the friendship circles that you had, the things that you didn't have, the things that you did have. It makes total sense why you behave like that. You know, as an adult, I can look at my parents and do a lot of that. At the same time, it's really important for me to not just look at logic and reason. And this is literally something that has occurred to me in the last 12 months. I try to say this to myself a lot. Both things can be true. There can be absolute perfect logical reasoning for why an adult or a parent behave in a certain way, especially my own, with their kid. I'm like, of course you did that. At the same time, I need to say, I felt really hurt. Not to them necessarily, but to myself. Like, I felt this because I spent a lot of my life being sarcastic about my feelings or thinking it's a matter of, like, I call it talking above my feelings, like having a cognitive understanding of my feelings but not feeling them, if that makes sense. But you can hear how, like, lackadaisical I've been about talking about some other things that people would not feel comfortable, or they would have some kind of shyness about talking about shitting behind a bus stop. It is funny. Again, both things can be true. Shitting behind a bus stop is funny when you're in a church group and it's 10:30 at night and you do it in this, that concept is funny. If I look at myself though, as a 13-year-old, I was so ashamed, so embarrassed. It's such a sensitive, vulnerable time of your life that I also have to remember to have compassion for that person. And I have to have that now, not just compassion, but, like, sometimes I have to sit down and spend time thinking about something so I can have a feeling about it. Because I go, oh, yeah, that was really bad. Oh, yeah, I felt really bad. Not like, oh, that was a trauma that you've carried. Like, if that happened to your baby, I look at babies now, just regular babies, and it's so emotional looking at them because they're these tiny, fragile, innocent balls of meat and bones. And they're magical. And you think, all people were that. All people were this tiny little baby. And I have to think of myself like that, that when I'm younger and I have these experiences, I can go, oh, yeah, I'm fine now. But actually, I'm not fine. I'm still in therapy. I'm on medication. I've been traumatized by certain events in my life and certain behaviors. And it's not a badge of honor. And that's right. What I've been carrying it as for 40 years.
I just want to highlight there, you've articulated so brilliantly that idea of both things being true. Mm. And two examples that it's got me thinking about is one personally, which is at times I can sound very harsh about my parents, and it's because of the level of honesty. I've also gone to a lot of counselling, and so I can articulate very accurately and very emotively.
Yes.
Where things went wrong within the family dynamic and the ways in which I was not the child that they expected, and they were in certain ways ill-equipped to deal with me appropriately, to parent me in the ways at times I needed. So that can be true, but also I really love them and I do genuinely think they're great parents. I think they did a great job, but I think any parent, there are gaps. And it just so happened some of the gaps for me were the areas that I maybe needed the most support in.
Yes.
And so that's a personal example. And then a more general thing you've got me thinking about that I think can apply for everyone that's experienced mental ill health is relating to parents, like where the responsibility is. So yes, absolutely, there can be trauma from our past. Maybe it's our parents, maybe it's school bullies, maybe it's the community we grew up in, whatever that could be, that is valid for you to acknowledge that trauma and to a certain extent, you know, reminisce on it in an appropriate way. But then also there has to be an element of ownership. You know, you can at the same time go through your life being like, okay, this happened and therefore I'm fucked forever.
I'm in therapy now, so I don't pass these things on, or I pass as little of my baggage onto my kid as I can. It's not just about me getting well for me. It's because I want to undo as much of what I was taught that wasn't how I would like to parent, you know? And there's lots of fabulous things that my parents gave me. They gave me an incredible work ethic. They're both working class people. Dad's a builder. Mum works in a department store. She's worked in bedding for like 15 years. When she was younger, she was when we were younger, she was a cleaner and she worked in merchandising. And I mean, to a fault, I can work. And we were always very validated by if you were working, then you were fine, you know?
We have that in common. Real workaholism, riddled. Great distraction from troubles. Yeah.
Absolutely appalling at setting my own boundaries with that. And the other thing that they gave me was that they didn't finish school. They just did their, I think they probably didn't even do their O levels. But they travelled. They travelled so much. So from the time I finished school, I travelled. I've done loads of travelling, and it's really, yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful gift that parents can give you, is the inspiration to travel and the encouragement. So you do have a perspective, a world perspective, and you do see how other cultures, other people live. So, you know, I'm from a town of 1,500 people, and that's a pretty small petri dish to get a sample size. However, there were things like, I didn't know there was such a thing as healthy anger. I only had rage. I didn't know if you had a feeling that you didn't have to take it out on someone else. I wasn't taught how to have a feeling and let the feeling come up and feel the feeling and try and let it pass. I was probably 35 before I went, oh, I don't have to take this out on everyone. Like I thought it was my right or something.
And also it just being okay, I think you being in the feeling. You know, sometimes for me, it's going to be a sad day, and fighting it only makes it worse.
Yeah. It can come out of nowhere too. It's like I woke up feeling really good this morning, and then we've got this dishwasher issue and it keeps delaying, and it's been happening for weeks, and I got really grumpy, and then my husband said something and I could feel myself getting frustrated and grumpy, and then I had to say to him, oh, I feel really sad and I don't know why. And he's like, that's okay. Even just saying it is like, if I keep it to myself and then I take it out on him later, then I can get away with my brain saying it's his fault, he's done something. Whereas if I confess to it before I've acted poorly, then it takes the heat out of it and everyone knows what's going on. You know, we're all on the same page. I'm not going well. I'm not traveling well is how I describe it. And so it's not like something I need to pretend I don't have. Does that make sense?
For sure. I think that's really lovely. And doing a dating podcast as well as this one now, that comes up a lot. Just actually communicate. Don't assume the other person is thinking all these horrible things about you. Don't project all your insecurities on them, because they may or may not be real, and they may or may not be things that that person's noticed anyway.
Yeah.
But it's interesting you talking about the dishwasher, because I think that really links to you started saying about lockdown. You know, on one hand, lockdown is the least of your worries. And I think it's such a crazy time for all of us, because it just so skews all of our perceptions. But it feels so intense, everything does right now.
Yeah, I had a baby at the end of November 2019, my bubba. And then I got 4 weeks later, after doing self-tapes with a newborn that had colic, I got a job in Australia on a big drama series. And then I got the job and they said, we need to know if you want to take it in the next, you know, week, couple of days. I took it, and then we had 3 weeks to pack up the house, get someone in, get my son a passport, get my husband and my son visas, pack for 4 months with a baby who's going to be 4 months. We had 3 weeks to do that, and all the time I didn't know that I had postnatal depression. And then we went out there and then it just continued. And it was like my ex-fiance died, a family member got really ill, we landed, our bassinet was stolen, we got to the Airbnb, it was covered in grease, there was rotting food inside. We had to call the ambulance twice while we were there because we thought that our son was choking. We landed during the bushfires, our air conditioning broke, the Airbnb didn't fix it for 2 weeks. Like, it was just non-stop body blows. And that sort of continued over the year, like last year during the pandemic, lockdown, then having to go back out to finish the shoot because we left with 4 hours notice to come back to the UK. So I had to go back out without my baby or my husband and then come back. And then we all got COVID at Christmas, and my husband's got a slipped disc. So it's just been like the dishwasher is not something, it wasn't like a huge thing. It was just like when you have a baby, it is like running a cafe and a laundrette with a baby walking around your shop. You're just constantly doing dishes and washing. And of course, living in the UK, you'll know that nothing ever dries in a flat. And it's always 5% wet year round. You're always just a bit wet, you know? Your clothes are damp. So a dishwasher breaking down or not being able to start immediately is a big deal for us. We're in a two-bedroom flat. We've got a toddler. It's cramped. So if I can't clear a bench of dishes, that stacks up pretty quickly. So its quality of life is really tricky to maintain as well.
No, I think that's really true. And just such a list of all the things that went wrong. Do you feel like there was a part of you or your anxiety that thought, this feels accurate, this is what we've been preparing for?
The pandemic did. I was like, yeah, I've been waiting for this my whole life. not the world falling apart, but no, there's lots of times where I've thought, you know, the amount of people that have said, you're so strong, you're so strong. You're like, oh, I can't actually take this. I'm just sustaining it. Like I was talking to someone yesterday, this is the only thing I know about boxing, and I learned it from The Simpsons, as all of us do. There is a technique in boxing called rope-a-dope, where some boxers attack and they just like they can punch and punch and punch and punch and punch, or they're really fast on their feet. They're really good at dodging. They're really good defense, right? And then there's this move called rope-a-dope, and that's when you can take body blows. You take lots of body blows, you tire the other fighter out, and then you can come back, reserve your energy, and then just punch them and you can knock them out. And I feel like I have just been taking body blows, but I don't think I have the energy to punch the whatever is on the other side out. I think that when people say you're so strong, I don't see that. I just see that I have a high tolerance for pain and struggle, which I don't want to be. I would like to have a very low tolerance so I can set better boundaries for myself.
Right. And also you're seeing it 24/7. You know, you're having the sleepless nights, you're having the IBS, you're having the, I hear one headline and it ruins my whole day. And I'm terrified about my kid's future. You're having all of that 24/7 in a way that they're only seeing snapshots of you seeming to do okay.
Yes.
And I think I've had a similar version of that where a lot of people have assumed I'm doing really well. And I don't actually think I'm doing better than anyone else. I think I'm maybe just more used to struggling. It's like a tolerance, a resilience. And so my friends that are doing the worst are the ones that had a fairly stable 9-to-5-ish life before that's been totally decimated.
Yes.
Whereas whilst this situation is new, working from home a fair bit, turbulence in mental health, in finances and everything else. Like there's so many stresses that are not exclusive to this situation for me.
Yeah, I mean, I've been self-employed for 12 years. I work from home or I go writing in a cafe. That's what I'm missing, is that I can't go to a cafe and write. It's the same four walls. When I was depressed, I would stay inside a lot anyway. And actually, when the pandemic first hit, I didn't get a proper maternity leave. So when we came back here and we had to be indoors for 6 weeks with our baby, it was like I actually got a chance to bond with him properly and learn about him and not go, okay, I've got to go to work and, you know, leaving him. And we got a chance to become mates. And so the first lockdown was in some ways I really liked, but I still had postnatal depression. That didn't improve. I'd seen a couple of different therapists and then I got a different therapist because it was like limited sessions because it was done through the NHS. And then I got a therapist that I see weekly that I see privately, and the medication that I was prescribed kicked in. And it was the first time like I felt like I could cope with a problem since the baby was born. So he was like 6 months then, I think, 6 or 7 months probably was when I felt like I could start coping.
And what kind of symptoms of the postnatal depression were you having before that?
The show that I was working on, the woman who wrote it basically wrote the show because she had postnatal depression. So one of the characters in the show had postnatal depression, and it was set in a mental health hospital and I was playing a nurse. So that's what I was filming while I had postnatal depression.
Wow, which sounds very triggering, and like you must have felt you were playing the wrong part a lot of the time.
Yeah, like you couldn't write it. If you put that in a script, it would seem a bit on the nose. But the showrunner, she talked to me a lot about her postnatal, and that was like invaluable having that on set. And she described it as she loved her baby, but she was allergic to their cry. And that's exactly what it was with me. I was allergic to my baby's cry. And if he was crying, I couldn't handle anyone else holding him because I didn't think they could fix it. And I couldn't deal with the feeling that I wasn't trying to fix that sound. The feeling that I got when I heard him cry was too big for me. It was too powerful. But if I was holding him, at least I was trying to solve that, if that makes sense.
Sure, but did you still feel ill-equipped then to deal with it yourself? Oh. So it's like no one else can hold him, but also I'm inferior to this situation.
Oh, there were plenty of times where I just thought, I'm just going to get in a car and drive forever. That's it. I'll just go because I can't. Yeah, I just couldn't contain. And it felt so unreasonable. It's, you know, there's a reason that sleep deprivation is a form of torture, that people get charged for war crimes for that. You go insane because I was sleeping 3 hours a day. It was just that feeling of like medium level terror at all times. What's going to go wrong? Am I going to say something that will piss off my husband? Is my baby going to cry? You know, like there was one day when we're on set, and if it was any other time, I'd go, God, that's a bit of a surprise, but okay. And I got my scripts. The next day I was supposed to have one scene, to shoot one scene. And then I got my scripts through and an adjusted call sheet, and it said I had 5 scenes. And I just called my agent. I'm like, I can't do this. Like, I can't learn 5 scenes overnight. This is unreasonable. And it was just like I was freaking out. I'm like, I've got a baby. I've got to get to sleep at, you know, in an hour. I have to be awake at 5 a.m. I can't. It was just like everything was an avalanche. You know, anything can be the trigger, and you can have that feeling that it's all coming down and that this is the moment that you're going to snap. This is the end. And it just felt like that was going to happen at any point until I just dissociated. Like there was one point when I found out my ex-fiance had died. I just sort of said, yeah, of course he has. Like I just couldn't even conjure a feeling because there was too many of them. I'm like, nah, that's the end.
Right. And that's so honestly spoken. I think, you know, that's so similar to any of my friends that have gone through postnatal depression and the exhaustion of it. And I think from what you've told me so far, it feels like throughout your life, maybe the area you've had the most experience of is that unrelenting, like you said, medium level terror, whether it's anxiety related, depression related, there can be so much crossover. And what you're getting in that is no break, no let up. So right, just from relentless. Your dad and the turbulence at home, you know, even the times when he did pick you up, well, he's probably just going to let me down next time. Or, you know, the baby's not crying right now, but at any moment it could start.
Yeah, it's that readiness. You're like, you know, when you were saying, I can tell when someone's going to disappoint me, I was going to make a joke as like, you know, you're making the mistake of assuming anyone is going to show up for you. If you just assume everyone is going to disappoint you, then you're always right or pleasantly surprised, which is a very like cynical joke, and not that I actually believe that. That's, you know, that's how I protect myself, is make it sound like it's just a funny joke that people disappoint you, when actually it's really painful and I feel it more than anyone else. There was a guy who walked around where we lived when I was 10 or 11 or whatever. And he was a local guy and he was in his 60s and he was a bit of a psychic. And that's what he said. And he told my mum this thing and it's always stuck with me. And two things. One, he said, Felicity's going to have success later in life, but she will have it. And then he also said she's got a porcelain heart. And I don't believe in psychics, but I was like, that is the most accurate description of what I have. I have a porcelain heart. It's really beautiful. I have a lovely heart, but it can be smashed so easily, and it smashes. It doesn't crack, you know? Yeah.
And I'm interested within the context of comedy then, dealing with that, because I think there can be such a temptation to, for the sake of your work, hold these things up in a funny way, and then it almost feels like a choice. Like, I'm kooky, I'm quirky, I've got all these things going on. Look at me, isn't my life messy? Because in finding the humour, it can feel like you're gaining power. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you've got like the Hannah Gadsby perspective of, is that keeping you in that trauma? Because you're finding the joke rather than finding the solution.
Well, one, I've always been very clear that I never work stuff out on stage. You know, I go to a therapist to work stuff out. I do not do it on stage. I do not rely on my audience to get me well, if you know what I mean, because that's really dangerous for me. If I'm telling hyper-personal stories that I'm not ready to tell, then it's dangerous for me and how I recover from that. And it's also, I think it's irresponsible to put that on an audience, that you're working your shit out on them when they're not qualified. And in the past, my shows have been really personal, really self-deprecating. And it's interesting because I put something self-deprecating on my website. My husband said, why are you doing that? And I went, it's funny. And he said, but that's not who you are anymore. Like, your stand-up is just, because the last show I did was just an hour of jokes. I made a couple of, you know, jokes about mental health, as I usually do, but the shows before that were like hour-long meditations on, I did a show called What If There Is No Toilet, and that was my anxiety and IBS show. And then I've done other shows that had facts about mental health. And then the last one I did was, it was just an hour of stand-up, and that's what I really love and what I really enjoy. And it's not as self-deprecating. And it's funny, when my dad sees my stand-up, he, when it's very self-deprecating, he doesn't like it. He doesn't enjoy it. He's like, it's too painful. It's too painful for me to watch you speak about yourself like that. And he's like, he just can't watch me be in pain or be threatened, even if that's by myself. And it's funny because I'm like, oh, come on, Dad, like, it's just a joke, blah, blah, blah. And he just can't, he just doesn't find it funny. And
yeah, but I think part of that is you see the truth behind it.
Yeah.
And the more I kind of delve into the comedy world, the more I'm, I think, falling for what happens to a lot of comedians, where you start to become a little bit immune to comedy because you start to analyse it more and more, and you sit there thinking, that's a really interesting take, as opposed to, oh, what a funny way of phrasing it. And I think the empathy that I work on with myself as well also adds to that. That I can see the truth behind a lot of these bits. And I think maybe that was the case for your dad, because he knows you. Even the stuff that's, you're playing a character to an extent, he can see the truth of where that connects.
I try to say that to other people who are like, who are not being nice about themselves. You know how people say, oh, you've got to be your own best friend. And I always thought that was such a trite thing to say. But actually, I rephrase it to say, think of your best friend in the world. Would you say that to them if they were going through what you were going through? And I thought about my best friend and I'm like, oh my God, that's such an awful thing to say. I would never say that to her. So if that was like my son, when he grows up, if he does stand up, God help him. But if he was talking about himself like that, I'm like, you're talking about my little boy like that. Don't you speak about my little boy, my perfect angel. Don't you speak about him like that.
Right.
You know, as a parent, you want to help your kid if they're speaking about themselves like that. Except in my 30s at that point, and too late. And my dad doesn't have the tools to help me speak nicer to myself.
And I think that really speaks to the kind of cycle of life and the type of parenting that's so overlooked, which is parenting yourself. Because I think there are clear points in your life, like leaving home, like your parents are getting elderly. There's certain things where the dynamic shifts. And that was something that I feel very lucky for in some regard, that I really was a parentified child and was parenting myself from a young age. That is not ideal, but it is a big part of how I survived a lot of mental illness. And I think that's really helped me take some of the pressure off my parents, but also take some of the pressure off me of like, okay, I've got to find a way to be compassionate, even at the times in my life where I look back on and I'm quite embarrassed by myself. But I can't lose the context of that's where you were, that's what you were dealing with.
Yeah. I think I said it to a therapist and I said, oh my God, I feel a bit embarrassed for myself. I was so annoying. And they said, you were 7. And I was like, oh, I know, but I was so much. You're talking about a 7-year-old kid. They can't be anything else. Yeah. When they said that, like always, I sort of went, well, whatever. Now I think about it, I'm like, fucking hell. Like, is that how you'd speak to a 7-year-old? Like, I've got a niece who's 8. I'm like, I would never say that to her. She's doing the best that she can. She's the only person she can be.
And it's funny that how we can recognise it when it's externalised. Like, even the ways where we can traumatise ourselves, we can see how that's a problem for other people, but we're like, oh, no, we can take it. I don't deserve better than that.
And even you saying I don't deserve better than that, I have, like, such an affliction for basically the wellness industry has co-opted a lot of vital language of the mental health industry. And so when I hear phrases that the wellness industry use, I bristle, because I don't want to be, I'm sure you will identify with this. I don't want to be a cliche. I don't want to use platitude in how I heal myself or how I recover. It's, you know, like there's perfectionism even in how I get well, that it has to be the right way and in an interesting way. Like, fuck.
I know, as if you haven't got enough to worry about, but I think that's part of being in the public eye. Also an element of the internalized stigma we can have. You know, sometimes I see things on Instagram, like these snappy little quotes, and they feel very real. and relatable. And I'm just like, yuck. Like, how dare they come here with one sentence that explains my experience so well?
I have a 5-minute stand-up bit that I did on Live at the Apollo about Instagram posts, about how people are trying to be an inspiration. I think the line is, I love watching my friends post inspirational quotes that they definitely don't live by.
Yeah.
And now, here's the great irony, Instagram quotes, I'm like, embarrassing. Then I see some 14-year-old on TikTok going, this is the sound of healing. This is, you do this to massage your lymph nodes. I'm like, no one's watching. I'll massage my lymph. Taking advice from a 14-year-old who's just copying it from another one of 14-year-olds. It's not a doctor. And I'm like, well, maybe they've got the answer.
And that's it. We both want simple answers, but also we get them when we're like, no, that can't possibly be that simple. Being nice to myself will help me feel better. No, there's got to be something else I can do.
Oh. I remember years ago, I sort of befriended this woman and she's fantastic and we really got along and she was doing really well at her job and she just seemed like she had a shit together. And she said, oh, what are you doing tonight? And I said, oh, I don't know. And she goes, you know what would be a nice thing for you? And I said, what? And she goes, you should have a bath and then like exfoliate your body. And if you've got any expensive creams or cleansers, and then when you get out, really take your time to moisturize your body. I'm like, what is this wacko on? And then when I do that, I'm like, oh, I feel really good. Oh, is this why she suggested it? Like a bath is too simple for me.
It's tricky, and I think that links to what you said about the kind of brands co-opting a lot of mental health language, because it's this mixed thing of like, absolutely, these products can help in self-care, but also I'm very wary of the idea of self-care in itself becoming a product. Like it has to be self-care, something you spend the industry money on. Yeah,
yeah, where actually a bath is self-care, and one, you're being clean, and two, you're relaxing, and scientifically it's good for you. But it's like, okay, if it's scientifically good, then I'll do it. You know, yeah, sometimes it's exhausting being in my brain, the debate that goes on. And I've used this analogy before, but my brain is so comprehensive. I can have an argument, a full court case with someone else in my head, and then I'm coming up to them with the closing statement, and they're like, I didn't even know I'd been subpoenaed. Like that's...
Yeah.
Like, you know, like in closing, this is a non-negotiable. And my husband's like, what's a non-negotiable? I'm like, what we've been talking about is like, we're watching TV. I'm like, oh yeah, I haven't spoken to you about this at all.
Yeah, I've done that a fair bit with one particular phrase, which it's very useful, but a lot of people do not like hearing it. And I do understand that. I will say it's not up for debate is one of the ways I just shut something down.
Sure.
And yeah. It's a bit like that, because the behind the scenes is I've done the calculations, I've done the debate, and I've thought it's not worth us getting into it. So I've got to that point, and then it feels very harsh. But I know what would be harsher is us having an argument right now. So
and me saying the things that I want to say.
So it's an ongoing process trying to figure out how much of all the craziness in here is appropriate for the world, and also not letting that be shame. You know, filtering it for appropriateness, not for I'm disgusting, I can't let anyone know me.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Like, my husband didn't know I could draw till about 6 months ago. We've been together for nearly 8 years. But there's just little things and I'm like, no, we'll just keep that. You know, and sometimes he says to me, you know, that's a positive thing that I've kept from him. But sometimes he goes, I just don't know what goes on for you. Like, you're reacting to something that I don't know that it's happening.
Mm.
I think lots of people who have, again, it's that readiness that you're like, I have to be ready. And then if they do what I think they're going to do, I'll be prepared. And what I am is preparing for something that's echoing from my past, but I'm defending it now with someone who wasn't there, who doesn't know what the fuck I'm talking about.
Right. And it's exhausting because you're constantly focusing on all of this stuff. And actually what's not happening, you're not planning for the good stuff. And then sometimes the good stuff happens, or somebody says something really nice about you and you're like, what do I do with this?
Yeah. And you know what? Like, I even have answers and, you know, rehearsed answers for if someone gives you a compliment, you're like, oh, thank you so much. Rather than going, what does that feel like? When someone says thank you, what does it feel like? Not like, you're welcome, no worries. You know what I mean? Like batting them away. with rehearsed answers, like acting as one should, rather than hearing what they're saying and feeling it.
For sure. Sadly, I'm looking at the time. We do need to wrap up, but I think people will have connected with so much. We've got into so many different areas of mental health. Any final tips that you found helpful?
Go to a doctor as quickly as you can. That's what I would say, to get a referral. I cannot recommend therapy enough. And the hardest part about therapy is you might not find the person you need straight away. And I have been very resentful about that last year. I was very resentful. As I said, I went through four therapists to get to the one that I am seeing now. And I would just get angrier and angrier. And what it takes is radical honesty and not just spouting out the same story that you know how to tell.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, we all have to take that we can pop in.
Definitely. I know I'm doing therapy wrong when I hear myself selling my life, because that's the same thing I really fall
selling
prey to.
Selling your life. Yeah. Tell you my trauma. Tell you the story.
No, no, it's not even that. It's selling. I start talking about achievements and how well I'm coping with the things.
Oh.
Whereas actually I'm meant to be there telling her these are the things I'm not coping with. And so that's when I'm like, okay, you're not putting in the effort here. You've got to come and be raw. And I know it's uncomfortable, but it's good for you.
Well, I sell my trauma, but I sell it like a musical.
Yeah.
You know, it's a show. It's a show. This happened. Look how damaged I am. But it's not like, please help me with my damage. It's not a humble asking. I'm not acknowledging that there's anyone else in the room. It's an audience, you know. It's not a professional who's going to help me. That's when I know I'm not being, again, I bristle at the word authentic. Blah.
I think that's so true. What a great point to end on. And so if you are still managing to keep up with work and doing some things in the horror of Zoom, where can people find you online?
If this comes out before the 12th of February, I'm doing an online work in progress show at the Leicester Comedy Festival. So that will be a Zoom show. Otherwise, my Twitter handle is Felicity Ward. My Instagram handle is Felicity Ward. My Facebook handle is Felicity Ward. I did a show called Episodes on Radio 4. There are two seasons. The last one's just come out. But the first season was on anxiety. One episode was on anxiety, one was on depression, one was on irritable bowel syndrome, and the fourth one was on insomnia. So they're about using apps to try and cure these things that we have. So there's two series of that if people want to listen to that. It's on the BBC Sounds app.
Great. Brilliant. Well, thank you for that. And if people want to see your comedy and they don't get to the Leicester Live performance you're doing, I just really recommend Googling you, and you can pretty much put in most mental health diagnoses next to her name and you will find some jokes about it. And honestly, you know, I speak to a lot of comedians and I think you are right up there as one of the best for balancing the humour and the relatability, but also the honesty. So on the authenticity, even if you hate the word, you get a tick from me.
Well, I feel that, and thank you very much. I really appreciate it. It's been wonderful. It's been a lovely chat.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.